In today's news, a few stories of Klondike Christmas's past, and our weekly feature essay with Heather Lendy. As the many children of the Lynn Canal ready themselves for Christmas and a visit from Santa, here is a story of a real girl, Klondy Nelson, born in 1897, named after the Klondike, and an account of coming north to Alaska and Christmas spent at Ophir Creek, where herders used to raise reindeer, and where miners hired one of those herders to play Santa for Klondy's first Christmas. When Klondy Nelson was born in 1897, her father had insisted on naming her after the Klondike, the newest gold strike in the North. 2 weeks later, he left South Dakota for that very gold rush. Klondy and her mama had not seen him since. Klondy's mama had come over from Sweden only the year before and could barely speak English. When Klondy was 5 years old, she and her mama traveled thousands of miles to join her papa in Alaska. The Arctic air was chilly when they arrived in Nome in October 1902 on the last boat of the season. Hundreds of people were milling about the beach, gathering their supplies or panning for gold, but not her papa. He was at his claim 60 miles away in Ophir Creek and had sent his partner, Blueberry Pete, to meet them. After a long trip by horse-drawn coach and dog sled, Klondy finally found papa. He was a big, dark man in a long fur coat standing in front of a tiny cabin buried under the snow. Their new home was just big enough for a double bunk for her parents, a small bunk for Klondy, a wood stove, a tiny table, one chair, and a few shelves made of packing crates. The whole place was smaller than her bedroom back in Blacktail Gulch. Even though she had no playmates, Klondy discovered many things to do in Ophir Creek. She watched the reindeer herders in the nearby hills. She helped her mother make caribou and rabbit stew. She played with the new rag doll her mama made out of one of her papa's old socks. But she longed to spend time with her papa, who worked long hours on his mining claim. Many nights he did not get home until Klondy was already asleep. When December came, the temperature fell to 50 degrees below zero. It was too cold to play outside, even with the warmest fur parka. Plus, it was dark almost all of the time, with only a few hours of dim twilight around noon. So Klondy and her mama spent their time indoors, planning a traditional Swedish Christmas. They made cranberry and popcorn chains and Swedish cookies for the Christmas tree at the miner's bunkhouse. On Christmas Eve, when Klondy entered the bunkhouse in her pretty red dress and her hair and ringlets, some of the miners began to cry, missing their own children far away. They showered her with presents of gold nuggets. Her papa made her a tiny dollhouse from a syrup tin. After a long winter of work, Klondy's papa found little gold in his sluice box. So the next winter, the family moved to the nearby town of Council, where they bought a store and her papa quit prospecting. For a while, Klondy had other children to play with, a school to attend, and a new baby brother named Ophir. Although Council was just a small mining settlement, a German professor lived there who gave Klondy violin lessons. But Klondy's papa was not a successful shopkeeper and took up prospecting again. He set out for Nome with Blueberry Pete and staked the solo mine on the newly discovered third beach. There he finally struck it rich and bought the family a beautiful white house in Nome. That was an excerpt from the book Children of the Gold Rush, written by Claire Rudolph Murphy and Jane G. Haig. Have you ever wondered how those miners of old spent their Christmas? And an excerpt from A Gold Miner's Life in Dawson City, 1898-1901, posted by Cynthia Von Hall on the National Park Service website, hopeful miner Jeremiah Lynch writes his historical accounts of those times. Jeremiah had been 46 days on a long voyage from San Francisco and was excited to start a new life of mining. In December, Jeremiah's description of cold sets the scene for winter. He says it is so cold that energy, ambition, and even life itself seem not worth the value of a warm fire and comfortable apartment. On December 21st, the sun rose at 10 and set at 2, thermometer 45 degrees below zero. The stars were bright, and the ice and snow were so clear that it was quite easy to travel by night as by day. On Christmas night, Jeremiah's party dined in a restaurant in Dawson. The dinner consisted of moose, caribou, and ptarmigan. He describes many meats available from the abundant wildlife, from hares and mountain sheep to little gophers and graylings fished from the lakes. A year later finds Jeremiah a successful miner who prospered along with Dawson itself, changing from single-roomed cabins and tree stumps on the streets to neat felt shoes and well-appointed cottages of several rooms. During the holidays, he and friends obtained fernery for decorating by digging under the snow. They gathered berry bushes with red twigs and branches like mistletoe. Musicians played simple good old tunes in harmony while the men and women dined in evening dress, feasting on French cuisine. Such was Christmas in Dawson City. Another miner, William White, describes Christmas in letters written to his family back home in England. William's first mention of Christmas was in a letter dated October 9, 1898. "My dear father and mother, ever since leaving Bennett last June, we have had a young Scotch midshipman traveling with us, but he is now about to leave us and return to Glasgow so as to be home for Christmas. Lucky fellow, how I envy him that privilege." Next, at the last day of October, he writes to his family, "It has just struck me that you will be anxious to send me a small package of letters, papers, chocolates, etc., and as Colonel Hayes is going to Vancouver, I am getting him to bring a few things I am likely to run short of. I have had no further letters or news from you since that one letter last month, so anything addressed to me could be called for by Colonel Hayes of Australia. In case I should be unable to get my Christmas letters out in time, let me hastily wish you all a very, very, very happy Christmas. You will all be in my thoughts, dear ones. There will be a little Christmas for me. Your loving Will. P.S. I am doing well and shall be back before Christmas 99 with something worth coming for." About 12 days later, William writes home again, full of expectations and news for Christmas celebrations. He looks forward to a chunk of roast for Christmas. He describes a big party planned to celebrate the occasion with other English boys in the camp. He sounds a bit homesick and shares, "However we spend the holiday, my heart will be at home. I have never spent Christmas away from you before, and the remembrance of the happy times we have always had will make me feel just the least bit homesick, I expect. But never mind, we'll all be together again before next year's Christmas is upon us, if God's will be so good to me." William closes the letter by saying, "Be sure and take care of yourselves and your appetites at the treacherous season." When the holiday season finally arrived, Will sent letters home describing how they kept up Christmas in the good old country style. He shared a Christmas Eve dinner with 30 other miners. Apples, nuts, and oranges were absent, but they enjoyed a good spread with moose meat, plum pudding, mince pies, and a jolly good time. Whether they were on the losing end of a stampede or they were finding nuggets, Christmas was Christmas, and the miners of the Klondike Gold Rush observed the holiday with good food mixed with memories and home. And now with our weekly essay feature, Small Things Considered, here's Haynes author Heather Lindy.
You'd think after 30 northern Decembers I'd become accustomed to the darkness. But this year, even old songs that I used to like seem sad. You know, "Through the years we all will be together if the fates allow" has a whole new meaning now. It's not just about flying east for Christmas with the family anymore. It's about all those people who won't be at holiday gatherings ever again. And now the horror in Connecticut, which is so far away, yet in this season of school assemblies full of darling children with Rudolph noses and patient teachers leading little jingle bellers, it seems so terribly close. Then, on one of the darkest mornings of the year, my dog-walking friend said they were too busy for our usual daylight march along the beach by my house, where the Chilkat River meets the sea, and were going at 7 a.m. instead. That might as well be the middle of the night. I bundled up and turned my retriever's collar light on so I could spot her in the inky night of morning. Once I was beyond the light of my windows, I realized I could see more without a headlamp. I looked up and around, instead of down at my boots. The sky, all splattered with twinkling stars, was not black at all, rather a clear, deep blue with lavender edges. The snowy beach was bright. 5 miles up the frozen river, the airport lights strung out white, red, and green. Up on the icy road, a few street lamps made circles of gold. Lights switched on in the windows of my neighbors' homes, tucked into the spruce trees. I saw the dogs, or rather the neon light show of their glowing collars, before I saw my friends. Then we all spoke at once, Isn't it beautiful? The stars, the snow, the night lights, the mountains, sea, river, a snowy wilderness on one side, the little waking neighborhood on the other, with us walking unseen right up the middle. Looking toward the airport lights, one friend said, "It's the North Pole. See, Santa's landing beacon." When we turned and walked south, a big slice of moon rose over a mountain and we stopped and stared. In my preoccupation with the darker side of December, I had almost missed this light show. The great good news is that there is light in the darkness, lots of it. The snowy mountain ranges practically hug us, and all the constellations above them beam down. A bouncy pack of happy dogs runs ahead, and a Christmas tree sparkles in a neighbor's window. All we have to do is step outside and adjust our eyes and our hearts to all the comfort and joy our world has to give.
That was Haynes author Heather Lindy with our weekly essay feature, Small Things Considered. Wishing all in the Upper Lynn Canal a very happy holidays. From the KHNS Newsroom, I'm Adam Richard.